Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. The way we make doctors in this country is we put them through a lot. We ask them to memorize tons of information. Then we ask them to perform what they've learned in life and death situations when they haven't had a whole lot of sleep. It's basically a marathon of extreme learning. But we're about to meet some medical students who are making that training even harder for themselves. They've traded their classrooms for a soggy nature reserve in New Jersey. It's raining, it's cold, and they are camped out here for a week.
So last night, we had them create shelters that they would sleep in, where they would sleep with no tent, no sleeping bag, no matches, no nothing. And it was about 38 degrees and raining all night.
That sounds like an out there way to do medical training, right? But apparently the lessons learned here during that 1 week stick with these future doctors for their entire careers. On today's show, we're going to explore extremes and what we can learn from them. Extreme health conditions, extreme opinions, ideas, and extreme measures to reach your goals. To start us off, let's get back to those med students sleeping under tarps. This is all part of a course they are taking on wilderness medicine.
Teaching our students to be facile with providing care in any austere situation. That could be on a roadside at an accident, it could be on an airplane, it could be in the backcountry, it could be in a disaster scenario.
That's Pete Zanneman. He's an ER doctor and he heads the Wilderness Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania. He even looks like an outdoors kind of guy. He's tall, muscular, sturdy. You definitely want him to come find you if you've broken your leg on a long hike. He told me the course begins with a week in the classroom where students learn some of the basics of wilderness medicine, hypothermia, altitude sickness, how to deal when resources are scarce or after a disaster.
So we're not just talking snake bites and bear attacks.
We are including snake bites and bear attacks, but it's far more broad than that.
And then all of those skills are put to the test when the students head into the, quote, wilderness, or, you know, as wild as it gets in New Jersey for their camp. On the day I meet up with them at the nature reserve, they've taken over a wide meadow near the woods. A steady rain is coming down, it's really cold, and instructor Pete Zanneman has asked me to be a fake patient. So we're coming up with my scenario. I'm going to be a birder who has fallen from a tree, and I even find a way to explain my recording gear.
So I could be trying to catch the sound of a specific woodpecker.
This is very creative. I had you more as a really foolhardy, like trying to put a baby bird back in his nest.
Next, I meet Marco Juracek. He is a wilderness EMT slash makeup artist with bags and boxes of fake blood, purple makeup for bruises, and all kinds of other things.
Ew, that is disgusting.
Leg bone, actually.
Is it real?
Yeah, it's real.
What?
It's real. It's a real leg bone. And it's going to be coming out of your leg.
Where did you get this?
It's from a deer.
When we're done, my leg looks like it's really broken. That bone is sticking out of my flesh. It's gross. Then I sit under a tree with my back against the tree trunk and my mangled-looking leg stretched out. I'm shivering, and I'm waiting for my rescuers. Finally, they come.
Hello, ma'am. We're the private team. We're here to take care of you.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, ma'am. My name's Brian.
Hi, Brian.
It's Ronnie, Joe, and Jonathan. We're going to be taking care of you.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
I'm trying very hard to channel my inner actress.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened real quickly?
I'm a birder, and I went up into this tree.
Okay.
And then I fell, and I hit my side.
Okay.
And then I came down, and my leg is broken.
Okay.
The students examine me for injuries.
Any pain anywhere that I touch?
No.
Okay.
They stabilize my leg, and then they decide the best thing to do is to call an ambulance and to get me to the hospital.
What's that?
The ambulance has arrived, so we'll get you to the hospital soon.
Thank you.
I take a bow for my acting skills as a fake patient, and then the entire group talks about how this team did.
What feedback can you give to these guys?
I thought you all did a good job of like communicating with each other, but one thing that wasn't...
Yeah, I really liked how when Brian came up, he did a really great job.
I think Saloni did a really good job as leader, kind of taking a step back.
Brian, you killed it, I thought, in a good way.
I mean that the Sanneman says this is the real value of this extreme training, to learn how to be a leader or a follower in tough situations, making these students confident, boosting their ability to take charge. Of course, going from fake patients to real situations is a whole other story. I talked to Kevin Gardner about that. He's a doctor now, but he took this course 2 years ago. A few months after taking the wilderness medicine course, he was doing an icy, snowy winter climb of Mount Whitney. Conditions were tough. He made it to the top at 14,000 feet, and then he began his journey down.
About 300 feet below me, something kind of caught my eye. There appeared to be what I thought was an animal kind of stumbling around, and I look closer and I realize that it's actually a person.
Gardner saw imprints in the snow that suggested the person had fallen off a cliff and then tumbled down a slope. He got to the other hiker as quickly as possible. It was a guy in his 20s. He was clearly in shock. He was kind of out of it and yelling.
Oh my God, I fell.
Gardner says his training kicked in. He made a heat tent with a garbage bag and put dry clothes on the other hiker. He had to make a fire out of Band-Aids in his backpack. He found no major injuries on the other guy, so he guided him off the mountain. It took them 10 hours to get back to base camp. It was getting dark at that point, freezing cold. It was torture.
You know, I wouldn't have been as confident and prepared just to deal with a difficult situation in limited resources. I think what the course does best is it teaches you how to think critically.
That's Oakland physician Kevin Gardner. He practiced those skills in an extreme situation, and when the moment came to save a life, he was ready to perform. That's what we're talking about on today's show, extremes and what they can teach us. Now we're going to go from an extreme situation that taught valuable lessons to an extreme point of view that has been dangerous to all of us and frustrating to scientists. A few hundred protesters gathered in Washington, D.C. recently. They voiced an extreme point of view. They believe that vaccines are hurting people. They met with congressional representatives. They demonstrated in front of the White House. They attended a rally. Despite exhaustive science that has found again and again that vaccines are safe, the protesters called their event Revolution for Truth. Here's what some of them had to say.
Kids are getting sicker and sicker. Allergies, asthma, autism.
The last flu shot I had was 1996. I've never been so sick in my life from the flu.
I use Facebook for the sole purpose of spreading vaccine awareness.
Plenty of research that people can do on their own. They don't have to rely on the government to give them answers. We have a thing called the internet now.
I can't get behind faulty, corrupted science.
Show us the science and give us a choice. You say it. Show us the science.
This kind of sentiment is exhausting to public health researchers. They have shown them the science. But it seems the anti-vaccine movement just won't go away. There was a recent controversial documentary on the topic. Hollywood celebrities have gotten on this bandwagon. Even President Trump has taken to Twitter over the years to make dubious claims about vaccines. And with these voices loud and strong, pediatricians and researchers have had to up their game, the way they communicate and interact with patients to counter this all-out anti-vaccine position. Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
Paul Offit doesn't mince words when it comes to speaking out for vaccines. He's been doing it for decades. Offit's director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he has paid a price for being so outspoken.
It's the rare week that goes by without me getting some form of hate mail. The hate mail usually takes the themes of Nazis and Satans and, you know, going to hell and, you know, watch your back, that sort of thing.
Offit's also been the subject of several lawsuits. And there's more.
I got a phone call from a man who seemed reasonable enough. He said, look, we all want what's best for our children. I want what's best for my child, stating his name and age, and you want what's best for your children. Then he said, the names of my children. He said, the ages of my children. And then he said where they went to school, and then he hung up.
After that call, Offit considered stepping back. But in the end, he kept going. He says it's perfectly reasonable to be a vaccine skeptic, to ask questions about safety, but
what some people become are not skeptics, but cynics, which is to say that they don't believe the data. They think there's just a massive conspiracy to hide the truth, and therefore they shouldn't get vaccines no matter what the evidence shows.
Pediatricians find themselves talking a lot about vaccines and all of the research that shows they're safe.
Just checking all the regular stuff, all the body parts.
Pediatrician Andrew Wood is kneeling over six-month-old Mesa inside her family's living room in Philadelphia. The baby's about to get some shots and is laying on the coffee table for this home visit with the doctor. Wood opens a small black cooler. It looks like an insulated bag you'd pack your lunch in. He pulls out the supplies, fills a syringe from a small vial, and pokes it into Mesa's chubby leg. The usually giggly baby isn't happy about that.
I'm sorry. I know, that one tends to sting a little bit more. Yeah, I do that one last because it usually stings a little bit more than the other ones.
It's a slightly uncomfortable but familiar sound for parents after a vaccine trip. For Maze's father, Samer Aboud, the vaccination reminds him of a different pain experienced by his own father.
My father had polio when he was a kid, and he comes from a community where many people had polio. So he had cousins who had polio. My mother had cousins who had polio. It was actually something that was very common in the village that they grew up in Lebanon.
Aboud says seeing his father's health deteriorate has reinforced his own support for vaccination. His wife, Sonia Rosen, has put out a plate of sweets from a bakery in Morocco her family owns. She feels similarly about vaccines. Having them is a privilege.
The idea that like we could even consider not having a vaccine, whereas most of the world, when people have access to vaccines, it's like deeply desired, you know, because it can prevent stuff that kills people in very easily.
Pediatrician Andrew Wood enjoys these home visits. He no longer has a traditional doctor's office. He spends more time with his patients and is able to forge personal connections with the families in the comfort of home. He spends a lot of time answering questions.
I see my role more as to not pressure them or force them to do something that they're not comfortable with, but to give them my opinion, my expert opinion, and educate them as much as possible about the vaccines and then let them make a decision.
For Wood, it's all about his patients making informed decisions.
Right after do no harm, I'd feel like an informed consent is really probably the second most important thing in terms of the values in medicine.
About 5% of his patients don't follow the typical American Academy of Pediatrics schedule or refuse vaccination completely. Still, Wood says most of his patients end up getting their shots by kindergarten. Paul Offit from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia understands that doctors want to have these conversations with parents about vaccinations, but he wishes they would draw a harder line.
Pediatricians, especially young pediatricians, are going to have to go against their training. I mean, their training is to sort of be open-minded to all sorts of attitudes and beliefs and cultural differences, which is good up to a point, but this is that point. I mean, know that when you send a child out of your office unvaccinated or undervaccinated, that there's a lot of diseases out there that they could get and be harmed by or even killed by.
As a child, Offit had measles, mumps, and chickenpox. In a way, he says, vaccines are a victim of their own success.
Think about it for a second. We, in the United States, we ask parents to give, in the first few years of life, vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases, which can mean as many as 26 inoculations during that period of time. It can mean as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases most people don't see, using biological fluids most people don't understand.
The absence of these diseases and the fact that most people don't understand vaccines has proven to be fertile ground for misinformation. Of course, you've heard about British researcher Andrew Wakefield's 1998 study that claimed to have found a link between the MMR vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella, and autism. The work was debunked and has since been disproven. 17 studies have shown that the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. The modern anti-vaccine movement was actually likely born long before Wakefield's infamous study. In April 1982, when an NBC TV station in Washington, D.C. aired a special called Vaccine Roulette.
DPT, the initials stand for diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, three diseases against which every child is vaccinated. For more than a year, we have been investigating the P, the pertussis part of the vaccine.
The TV reporter Leah Thompson went on to make inaccurate claims about the shot for pertussis, better known as the highly contagious respiratory disease whooping cough. The program was criticized for using inaccurate statistics and a lack of hard science to back its sweeping claims, like this one.
The overriding policy of the medical establishment has been to aggressively promote the use of the vaccine, but it has been anything but aggressive in dealing with the consequences.
In the days after the program aired, the TV station gave callers the phone numbers of other people who'd already called with concerns about vaccines. The modern-day anti-vaccine movement was born. It spread with the help of the internet and celebrities like Jenny McCarthy and Robert De Niro, both parents of children diagnosed with autism. Back when Paul Offit started working on vaccines in 1980, he didn't envision himself becoming a defender of vaccines. But he says he'll never stop speaking up for vaccination.
We see at least one child in this hospital every year who suffers and occasionally dies from a vaccine-preventable disease, invariably because the parents made a choice not to vaccinate them. It's just a dangerous game to play.
That was Elizabeth Fiedler reporting on vaccines. And listening to her story, I was wondering, have public health researchers learned any big lessons from all of this in terms of dealing with extreme positions? I asked Alison Buttenheim. She's been researching vaccine attitudes for almost a decade, and she looks at this through the lens of behavioral economics. How do people make decisions? What are the biases that influence how we decide?
Humans really have this strong tendency towards what we call confirmation bias. So if they're looking for information, their brain is actually going to filter and look for information that confirms what they already know or believe. So even if the CDC or your pediatrician or an internet blog has a lot of great information, your brain won't even see it or pay attention to it. It'll scan to find sources and where you say, aha, see, I'm right. What's on the internet confirms what I already know. Understanding that helps us design interventions that can get around things like confirmation bias.
So if I'm a person who holds the most extreme position on vaccines, and I say absolutely will not do it, do not trust anybody, is there a way you can communicate with me? What have you learned about that?
That's a group that's really hard to reach. And, you know, there have been people who've been vaccine hesitant as long as there have been vaccines, so 200 years. And we haven't had as much success figuring out how to sort of flip those folks. The group where we probably have more opportunity is where the hesitancy is a little less strongly held, just something they've kind of heard from friends or kind of seen on the internet. They just don't feel quite certain or confident in following, for example, the recommended childhood schedule. That's where a pediatrician or a public health promotion campaign can think about how to frame that information, how to present the information to the parent, maybe think about social norms and social pressure. What are other people doing? That's another important behavioral economic concept. We really like to do what we see other people around us doing. And that's where I think we have ideas and opportunities for new interventions.
So is the real lesson you've learned that perhaps the most important work is to make sure that the most extreme positions do not spread into the middle ground people?
That's a great way to frame it. I mean, we think about vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusal being contagious, just like the diseases are contagious that we're trying to prevent. And so we look a lot at, for example, how vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusal is a clustered behavior. We see it clustered in social groups and clustered spatially. And once we think about it like that, we can almost treat it like an epidemic and think about how do we control it? How do we contain it? How do we prevent those ideas from spreading?
Alison Buttenheim researches vaccine attitudes. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about extremes and what we can learn from them. Extreme opinions, extreme circumstances. Here is an extreme idea for Lent if you want to give something up. How about trash? don't throw anything away, and whatever trash you do accumulate, carry it with you in a little bag. That's what Mary Kate Rainey did, and we caught up with her as she was grocery shopping during her 40 days of going waste-free.
GMO-free vegetarian jelly beans. Oh, man. And they're on sale. What a world we live in where I can get bulk GMO-free jelly beans. Yeah, so over the past several weeks, I have been not using trash cans. On Ash Wednesday, I decided I was giving up garbage cans for Lent. I thought I could do the usual thing of giving up cookies or sugar or, I don't know, some other junk food that I like to eat. But I wanted to do something that was better for the planet, better, that would make me a better person, and that people would care about more than just me not eating cookies for 40 days. Right now, we are at the East End Food Co-op, and this is where I'll do most of my grocery shopping because this is where I can do zero waste or no trash grocery shopping. There are a few other places that let you do it, but this, I found, is the best one. Waste that I've produced since Ash Wednesday fits in about a quart-sized Ziploc bag. It's a combination largely of receipts. I found that you can't get away from receipts no matter how hard you try. First place you want to go is you want to weigh all of your bags and you weigh all of your jars. That's because when you shop in bulk, you get charged per ounce and by weight, and so you don't want to pay an extra $5 because your glass jar weighs 5 ounces. So the first place we're going to go is we're going to go tear or weigh our packaging. You have to write it down. You can write it down on a little tag that they give you, but this also is trash. So I bring, you know, a scrap piece of paper that I had and we'll write it down on there. I define waste as something that you can't recycle and that you can't compost or that you can't reuse in some other way. So I don't keep anything that I can recycle or compost or anything like that. You can do a lot of simple swap outs to reduce your waste footprint. Like one of the first things I did was I swapped out my toothbrush, which is made out of plastic, and I swapped it for a bamboo toothbrush, which you can compost. And you can swap out like body wash and shampoo for a bar of soap and a shampoo bar, which you can buy over here unpackaged. And it's really just a lot of small changes. Like you look at how you walk through the day and you look at the trash you produce. And then once you identify it, you can make those small changes because they're not hard. You just have to think of them. All right, so we're at the checkout counter where if you're at, I don't know, a big grocery store, they will look at you weird if you have jars, but here it's the norm. You can ask for no receipt and they won't print it. I've got so many things. And that's spinach.
Okay.
And so, hold on, I've got all of my tares. And we've got the tomatoes, Brussels sprouts, peanut butter. All right, that jar is 0.41. And the PLU is 440. And that's it. That's everything. No, I would not like a receipt. Thank you.
That was Mary Kate Rainey. She gave up producing trash for Lent. Katie Blackley from our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh produced this piece. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show is about extremes today, and our next story is about extreme weight loss. For some athletes, it's not unheard of to lose 15 or 20 pounds in a day or two. It's called cutting weight, and it plays a huge role in certain sports.
Okay, first to the scales. From San Francisco, California, top rated in the junior welterweight division, here is Kareem Mayfield. 139.6.
If you're a professional boxer, there is big money at stake if you show up for a fight 1 or 2 pounds heavier than your contract requires. And even in high school or college sports, there's a lot of pressure. Andrew Stelzer visited a local gym to see how cutting weight is done and at what cost.
Boxers, wrestlers, Muay Thai, and mixed martial arts fighters do it, and so do weightlifters. They lose as much weight as they can and then quickly gain it all back at the last minute, supposedly to get a competitive advantage. At the El Nino Training Center in San Francisco, Josh Berkovich regularly loses about 25 pounds before a mixed martial arts fight. He usually gets about 7 weeks' notice and says the first 6 weeks are easy. Less carbs in your diet, exercise a lot, basic fat-burning stuff.
You're losing about a pound and a half to 2 pounds a week, right? So that should get you in range then for the final week to be 13 to 15 pounds over.
That's when things get serious.
And so the last week is then where the cut begins. You don't want to lose muscle mass. You don't want to lose strength, especially for an athletic performance. So the idea is, how can I become as lean as possible going into the week of the fight?
From then on in, it's all about cutting water weight. Remember, more than 50% of our body weight is water, so we should have some to spare, mostly through sweating. Here's how former Muay Thai fighter Albert Salopek did his largest weight cut.
You cover your skin with what's called Abilene, which is a makeup remover, and it opens your pores. Got on the treadmill and ran like 3 or 4 miles, and with your pores open, your sweat just comes off like a river.
Sweating out the water is one part. Then there's the flush. Daniel Kim, who also does Muay Thai, starts the flush phase by drinking as much water as possible the first few days of that week.
You drink all that water all through the day, and that gets you to start peeing a lot, right?
Then he drastically slows down his water intake about 3 days out.
And then 24 hours away from the weigh-in, then you stop drinking water. And then you're still peeing. And then you don't get to drink more water, but your body's so used to peeing at these hours, it pees out all this water, and then you start getting lighter and lighter and lighter. That's your body getting dehydrated. And then your urine gets yellower and darker.
Dark yellow urine is not good. People also experience muscle cramps, an irregular heartbeat, even paranoia. And even with no new water entering the body, the kidneys are still working overtime to get it out.
So we tell the kidneys flush, 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 and so they get going on that, and then we don't replace the water, so the kidneys keep flushing, and eventually there's no more water coming in, so we run a water deficit.
Krista Scott Dixon is a nutrition coach at a Canadian company called Precision Nutrition. She used to compete in hand-to-hand combat competitions called grappling. She'd cut 20 to 30 pounds before her matches.
There's an increased risk of brain trauma from weight cutting, and in a sport where you get hit in the head, that's a really big problem. There's fluid around your brain, and it has a job to do. So when we deplete that, that's going to be an issue too.
About 10 years ago, in her early 30s, Dixon went too far with her weight cuts and put herself into early menopause. Estrogen is stored in fat tissue, and she had so little fat in her body, she stopped producing that key hormone. That's only one of many risks. Rapid weight fluctuation can put stress on the heart, and repeating the practice can lead to eating disorders. Cutting weight is especially dangerous for adolescents, whose bodies need fuel not only to survive, but to grow. Greco-Roman wrestler Dante Burney started cutting weight when he was 13.
I've done 20 pounds within 3 days. I've done 30 pounds within maybe a matter of 3 to 4 weeks.
As a 150-pound high schooler in Indiana, Bernie's coach asked him to cut 25 pounds to fight a 125-pound opponent. He did that. Then the goalpost moved. His opponent had dropped down to the 119-pound class, so Bernie had to, too.
Talking to my coach, and I was like, man, I'm like, I don't know if I could do it. He goes, oh, maybe you're scared. And I remember after that, you know, that kind of like lit some fire under me. And all night long, I was running until I made the 119 weight class.
In the pros, the pressure is financial. In high school and college, it's about scholarships, pride, and accolades.
We had our match. The match started off great. I was up. And then second period began. He blasted me with a double leg. And after that, I remember just being in the hospital.
Bernie blacked out. Likely due to extreme dehydration, his kidneys had almost failed. He could have died. Doctors barred him from fighting under 140 pounds for the rest of the year. But Bernie wasn't scared away. As an adult, he took ephedrine, a fat-burning stimulant, to help him lose weight for another match, and ended up in the hospital again with a dangerous heart condition.
And at that point, I started to realize that it was pretty serious.
The point of cutting weight is to gain a competitive advantage.
My name is Kareem, hard hitter Mayfield, NABO champion,
San Francisco native.
Mayfield, who's a junior welterweight, cuts about 20 pounds so he can box in a lower weight class. But then after qualifying at the weigh-in, Mayfield spends the next 24 hours trying to gain all of that weight back by eating and drinking as much as he can. When he steps in the ring, he actually wants to be 20 pounds heavier than his opponent.
Wait a minute. It said he was 150 yesterday at the weigh-ins, and now he's 165. Like, how? People don't understand that.
This is totally legal in most cases, but the premise is faulty, since usually both fighters are cutting weight and then gaining it back before the fight. No one really gets an advantage, and everybody knows it, but they do it anyway. In the past few years, at least three MMA fighters died during weight cuts. In one case, the fighter was taking a diuretic, a medicine which makes the body expel water and salt through frequent urination. Other fighters take laxatives, hoping to lose a few pounds of poop before they step on the scales. Dave Zirin is host of the podcast The Edge of Sports. He says the mass media spotlight has begun to rein in the dangers of win-at-all-costs machismo sports culture.
It takes tragedy to provoke consciousness, unfortunately. Like, for example, with the issue of head injuries in football, you know, we have had decades of evidence. And yet it will take high-profile incidents, almost certainly of death, to be able to raise the awareness of the point where it's regulated in a way to the benefit of young athletes.
Sports organizations are slowly addressing what's become an epidemic. The NCAA, the governing body for college sports, has instituted rules to discourage rapid weight loss and gain in the days before a match. The UFC, the largest mixed martial arts promoter in the world, recently created a rule that fighters must be within 8% of their target weight 4 days before the fight. For The Pulse, weighing in at 197 pounds, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about extremes. Paleontologist Ted Daschler recently came back from a remote, desolate, bone-chilling field site, Antarctica. He studies the Devonian period about 380 million years ago. Antarctica was part of a different landmass then. It was warmer, plants were thriving, so were fish. The Devonian period is actually known as the Age of Fish. He told us about the experience just as he was opening up for the first time a crate of fossils that his team brought back.
All that hard work down in the Antarctic is represented by what's in those boxes and the science that we're going to do on them.
We'll tackle this one first. This box alone weighs about 150 pounds. Let's got 16 screws here on the top.
Got my Makita drill for opening up these crates. I'm very excited. I mean, I think I know. In a broad sense, I know all the objects that are in here. I mean, we packed them up. Here comes the top off. I forget some of the details, of course. Antarctica is definitely not an easy place to work. 98% of it is covered with ice, so there's not that much rock exposed. The rock that is exposed, much of it isn't going to have fossils. People haven't done extensive paleontology down there. A catch-22 in paleontology is, how do you know whether to go there if no one's ever been there before or found anything significant? We were camped for 3 weeks. Really cold, windy all the time. Tents would warm up a little bit sometimes when the sun was shining. It was never night there in their summer, so the sun never went down, but it was usually cloudy. Ooh, this is a good specimen, actually, right here. There's a scientific paper in this little bag. This is a ray-finned fish from the middle part of the Devonian period. We collected this on New Year's Day. We weren't having a lot of luck up in this one set of outcrops, and we had a snowstorm the day or two before, and so a lot of the rocks were sort of covered. ANT-16-13, Paleonicid nodule, January 1st, 2017. Wrapped in our toilet paper and then bundled up with masking tape. Yeah, we're going to sort of slice this gently. Toilet paper is really the magical thing to be able to wrap in. And it was awkward. At the research base, we were asking for our supplies. and we asked for 100 rolls of toilet paper, and they questioned it. And we said, well, we use it for a few things, and fossil wrapping being the most critical. And wrapping the fossils is a really key part of making sure they're safe. And it kind of became my job to wrap. My hands remain dexterous the longest in the cold weather, perhaps. So you can see I've got about a yard of toilet paper here, wrapping up quite a small nodule of fish bones. The evolutionary history of ray fin fish were just kind of the base of that tree, which has led to so many of the fish we think of and know of today. So that's a really good one. This morning we've unwrapped 1/100th of our stuff, and I think we're already seeing projects. That was fun.
Ted Daschler is a paleontologist at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. Irina Zhorov produced this piece. Coming up, we meet a little boy with an extreme medical condition.
He looked pale, wasn't making eye contact with me, and then he just opened his mouth and started vomiting. And it didn't stop. It just continued.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about extremes. Pete Mera is a bird researcher with an extreme take on something a lot of people love, cuddly cats. God, the cat people are going to get so mad at us.
So every year, we estimate that somewhere between 1.3 and 4 billion birds are likely dying due to cats.
So yes, Mera is saying your cute house cat, if it goes outside, is a killer, decimating bird populations and other species like lizards and rodents. And that is not a good thing.
A lot of the rodents that are taken by cats are native species that we should be protecting. Things like star-nosed moles or shrews or field mice, eastern cottontail rabbits. We need to protect these species. And these are all things that fall prey to cats.
So is there anything good about outdoor cats?
Frankly, no. We need to rethink what cat ownership is. In my opinion, we need to provide stimulation for these animals just like we would for a dog. We bring our dogs for walks, right? 40 years ago, dogs roamed free. And then we realized that actually, you know, we can't let dogs roam free because they get rabies. And they were the number one domesticated species to transmit rabies to humans. Now it's cats. So we got dogs under control. We put them on leashes. We need to do the same thing with cats. Maybe walk the cat on a leash, which you're seeing more and more, which is really fantastic. The cat can be stimulated by seeing things, seeing a bird, but not chasing the bird. That's the approach we need to take to cat ownership. And it can be just as satisfying. It's just not quite as easy.
What are some of the diseases that we have to be worried about with cats?
Rabies is one that is an issue. So cats, when they're fed outside, those feeding stations also attract other wildlife, like raccoons, which are carriers of rabies, common carriers of rabies. And when those cats and raccoons interact, cats can contract rabies, which happens quite often. The other issue is Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And cats, not just domestic cats, a lot of species of cats, are the definitive host for this parasite. Cats, at different times in their life, will shed, if they're infected, and about 30 to 40% of domestic cats we think are infected with Toxoplasma gondii, will shed lots of small little oocysts, which are essentially microscopic eggs, into the environment. They can shed them by the millions. The idea is that it will get into a prey item of the cat, and what it does is it manipulates the behavior of the host. So if it gets into a mouse, it will change, it'll go into the mouse and it will eventually go to its brain, will insist, and it'll start changing the brain chemistry. So that mouse that was afraid of cats before infection will all of a sudden become attracted to cats. And it's referred to as sort of this host manipulation idea. And by becoming, then, by forcing its new host in the mouse to be attracted to cats, it then falls prey to cats, and the parasite itself can continue its life cycle back in the cat. It's just fascinating. And so, and there are lots of stories in the parasite world.
That's so gross.
Yeah, it's gross, but it's fascinating from biology perspective. The problem is that there are lots of unintended hosts, because cats like to defecate in soil, loose soil, like sandboxes, in gardens. So it gets into people, and we now know, and there's been enormous numbers of studies showing that once it's in humans, it changes our behavior too. And it actually...
How so?
Well, it actually, studies have been shown that people that are infected with Toxoplasma gondii actually are attracted to cat urine and become more attracted to cats. And unfortunately, there's now a large body of literature that is showing that Toxoplasma gondii infection is significantly related to schizophrenia, suicide risk, mental health disorder, and a variety of other mental health illnesses.
Can I get these just from petting a cat, or does it always come out in the poop?
It's typically through fecal-oral transmission. So it comes out in the feces of the cat. Or we can get it through the food that we eat, through vegetables, through meat that's undercooked. And, you know, the pathway into that meat is from cats into the meat or on the vegetables or on the fruit. And it's not totally understood how it gets there, but it all starts with cats. And our environment has a lot. There's been several studies that sort of sample the soil in different places, sample meat, sample a variety of areas to look at the prevalence of oocysts, Toxoplasma gondii oocysts, in the environment. And it's quite common in the environment, unfortunately.
And how would I know if I had it?
So you'd have to get a test, an antibody test. But we know that up to 22% of people in the United States are infected with Toxoplasma gondii.
After all that, I had one last question for Pete Mara. Do you hate cats?
I do not hate cats. I actually like cats. I like all animals. That's why I do what I do. And I've known that since I was 6 years old. I'm passionate about all animals.
That was Pete Mara. He is a scientist, a researcher. His book is Cat Wars: The Devastating Consequences of a Cuddly Killer. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about extremes. And now for our series, Patient Files, we're going to meet a little boy who has one of the most severe food allergies there is. We also meet his mom, who has to watch him like a hawk at all times.
My name is Amy Marzolino, and this is my son, August. August is going to be 3 in April. And when he turned 6 or 7 months, we found out that August has something called FPIES, food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome. It boils down to his body not accepting food, so he can't eat. We found out when we tried to feed him, and we knew when he was 6 weeks old that he had some food intolerance issues, and he was diagnosed with milk and soy protein intolerance. But when he turned 6 or 7 months and started showing an interest in food, we fed him, and he got really, really sick.
And the petals?
Yeah, so we fed him some carrots, and maybe 2 or 3 hours later, he just started to look sick. He looked pale, wasn't making eye contact with me, and then he just opened his mouth and started vomiting. And over the course of the next couple of hours, he continued to vomit. He had diarrhea, and took him a couple of days to recover from it. So he reacts to tap water. You know, we give him spring water, and he goes in the pool. If he drinks any water with the chlorine, he'll react to that. I have to watch him all the time. So, of course, I'm the mom who's running across the playground when somebody hands him a goldfish, and I'm reacting as though it's a handgun or something, and I look crazy. And that's just a necessary evil of paying attention to this. We're very lucky. He is, his primary source of nutrition comes from elemental formulas, and so he drinks that out of a bottle. We're thankful that he's continuing to drink it out of a bottle. A lot of kids end up needing tube feeds to get the amount of formula in that is required for their nutrition. August. Bring it here. Let me see. He eats apples. and lots of them. Thankfully, that's a pass for us. He can eat pears, and he can eat beef that we sourced from a butcher whose cows are not supplemented with soy. You know, the older he gets, the less time he spends sick, but I would say the first year of his life, he was so sick that his hands were curled in toward his stomach, and he developed torticollis because he was in pain so much, his head was turned all the time to try and, you know, guard himself against the belly pain.
Let's go open it.
Okay, go ahead. Whoa. He's incredibly resilient. His personality is great. He's generally a very happy guy, and I think now that we've identified what things cause him pain, if we're careful, we can keep him comfortable. So there's kind of this magic third birthday that seems to be a turning point for a lot of kids. There's no empirical data to support a cure or a prognosis, except that we know that many kids grow out of it. You know, I hope one day he can eat. I hope he can grow up without carrying the worry that I have for him about touching the mulch in the playground and just other things that are completely normal and fun. And you know, like little things like having a birthday cake. I'd really like to get him a birthday cake someday. All right, buddy, let me get you.
Amy Marzolino and her son August. He is almost 3 years old and he has FPIES, that's a severe food allergy. We always love to hear your stories on our series Patient Files. If you have something you want to talk about, let us know. Best way to get in touch with us is on Facebook at WHYY The Pulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Tanya English, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.